to call this committee of the whole meeting to order for September 5th, 2017. May I get a roll call, please?
Mr. Davis.
Here.
Mrs. Deogracius.
Here.
Mrs. Hickey.
Here.
Mr. Martyri.
Here.
Mr. Moore.
Here.
Dr. Thompson.
Here.
Ms. Williams.
Here.
Okay, our first order of business always is to recognize visitors and invite comments from the public. Do we have anyone signed up for a comment? No, I do recognize most of you anyway. Approval of the agenda. We're going to amend the agenda to add right after it a quick communications report that is not reflected on the agenda. So what I would like to get is a motion to approve the agenda as amended to add that short communications report.
So moved.
Second.
Ms. Williams.
Yes.
Dr. Thompson.
Yes.
Mr. Moore.
Yes.
Mr. Martyri.
Yep.
Mrs. Hickey.
Yes.
Mrs. Deogracius.
Yes.
Mr. Davis.
Here. Yes.
And that brings on Ms. Hickey and
all
your
right.
communications report.
I have a piece of correspondence from Nancy Murphy at Murphy Law, 1111 Bonnie Gray Place, River Forest, Illinois, sent by email regarding the rescission of DACA. Dear President Aducci, Dr. Condon, Mr. Martyri, Ms. Gottlieb, other members of the board, teachers, and community. Written below in red is School District 90's newer June 2017 resolution of making the schools in River Forest inclusive. I was initially concerned that in the wording, with due respect, I'm not picking on the superintendent, I was wondering why one person and no explanation as to how that one person interprets and makes such a grave decision, gave Superintendent Condon the sole decision as to whether a child that was not born in the United States stays in school or goes with immigration officers. He would determine what legal papers meant and whether or not he had to follow what was written on them. He alone would decipher what should be done with each child slash family. Unfortunately, I was not at the meeting, so I do not know the reasoning behind one person making such a life-changing decision for another or for a family. I applaud you all for attempting to find a solution to an issue and situation that does not appear to be very far away. And while the superintendent was attempting to figure out what to do, ICE could be traveling to a classroom scaring children by trying to take a child out of school. When parents drop their children off at school in the morning, they expect them to be there at the end of the day. School needs to be a safe haven for the children of River Forest. Now that DACA is rescinded, I believe, and I imagine others may join me, that River Forest become a sanctuary village. The schools, at a minimum, should be not inclusive, but sanctuary. No one knows how this rescission will affect the children of River Forest or homeless children, but we need to do whatever we can to keep the children safe. And then there's a number or a page of text in red. And the conclusion, I'm almost done with a sheet we share in the legal community telling folks what they should do if they are picked up or questioned. I can share that with you if you are interested. I think we need to act on this quickly. I am happy to attempt a redraft of the resolution, or if there is an emergency meeting to make River Forest a sanctuary village, I will type, take notes, answer calls, make sandwiches. Just tell me what to do. Thank you for reading. Nancy C. Murphy.
She got me with the sandwiches. Yeah, no, so we had a broad discussion about this, and my understanding, and I bounced this off of Ed to make sure I wasn't missing the point, you know, he's the chief administrative officer of the district. And so these decisions involving a child would ultimately fall in Ed's lap anyway. Ed does have the access to our attorneys. The board really doesn't have a role in that decision. We have a role in setting policies. It's truly an administrative decision. And certain we'd be happy, Ed, I'm assuming you're going to follow up and meet with her or talk to her.
Yes, I offered either a conversation or meeting as soon as practical.
So Ed is going to follow up and talk with her, discuss, you know, the where's and why's of how we came about to the policy we have. But, you know, I think it is what it is. And so, Ed, yeah, you'll meet with her and you'll report back to the board?
Sure.
Excellent. And thanks for reading that in. And the part in red, just that everyone knows, we're not hiding any part of the letter. It's simply our existing policy. So we just didn't read our existing policy to you all again. It's on our website. It's available. Save Barb a little bit of lung capacity. All right, moving on. Does anyone have any questions? All right, let's move on to our Freedom of Information Act requests.
Yes, so we had received one request over the course of the last month or so, 3 weeks, regarding information from the collective bargaining agreement. The request was for the negotiated contract between the Board of Ed and the River Forest Education Association. Specific elements in the clause discussing the board picking up a portion of the teacher's required contributions to TRS. So we were able to respond to that immediately.
Great. Okay, board governance. And so you all remember that one of the items that came up for discussion at our retreat was trying to get a handle on everyone's vision for what we want as our legacy as board members, you know, down the road based on the actions we're taking. I think it's worth a little bit of discussion here at the COW meeting to see if you all came up with some positions. I know I have some feelings on things I would like to see as a legacy, but I'm happy to kick this discussion off in a very informal fashion. So is anyone that wants to weigh in? And Rich, does yours involve air conditioning?
We will be much cooler after we leave.
Do you have
a
formal comment? Yeah.
I think we all, in our conversations with everybody here, I think number one is to continue to offer the most rigorous educational experience for our students that is broad and does cover the needs, the social, emotional, and obvious educational needs of our students, with giving them, you know, the best, you know, paying for the best education, but also making sure that that we level the books every year and we make it easy for future boards to stay fiscally sound. So I think number one, at least from my perspective, is making sure kids go off to OPRF and Fenwick and St. Ignatius well prepared, not only academically but socially and emotionally.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And everyone, I'll just weigh in just to make this easier. I mean, everyone knows that one thing I want to see when I look back on the activity that we've all embarked in together over the last few years is that 5 years from now, maybe 7 years from now, there's no statistically meaningful differential between white and minority achievement at D90. That there is really no statistical prediction associated with a kid's performance predicated on their race or ethnicity. And I think I would like D90 to be a leader in that. I would like us to actually become a model for the rest of the state on how to address achievement gaps if you have the resources to invest appropriately. And so I think that's a big deal legacy. And I really want to see this board is, I mean, you all have been incredible in supporting the efforts on equity and inclusivity, and the prior board members that have just stepped off were the same, and I just would like to see that really become embedded in our system. This commitment to being an inclusive environment, this commitment to having an equitable opportunity for all kids, and equitable doesn't mean equal. I mean, it means fair, it means predicated on the actual needs of the child being served in question, so it's literally for each kid. And I view those as sort of legacy pieces, big legacy pieces for this board, and I really think we can accomplish that together. And I'm just going to tell you that as far as holding us out for a model, Ed and I are going to be having dinner Thursday with Dr. Whitaker. She's keynoting the Illinois Association of School Superintendents event in Springfield later this month. She's written books on culturally sensitive pedagogy and that kind of thing. It's really one of her focuses of her professional career, and she's the keynote speaker, and she may actually mention our efforts as part of her keynote speech to the state's Superintendents Association. I think that would be fantastic. And the board should know we've been invited to write an article for
The IASBO Journal.
The IASBO Journal. And it will also be focusing on our equity efforts. So hopefully we'll be successful, because we sure as our heck are going to be talking about it. But I think that's right. I mean, if you're gonna devote the resources and the effort, I would like to see that devotion pay off with actual outcomes. And we've already attained some outcomes, and we've already implemented a number of the recommendations from the equity committee. So that would be it for me.
Thank you. I guess my major concern is that having put devices into the hands of each child in the district, I am concerned about the careful use of those devices. I'm concerned that the use of social media has really changed the landscape of education, and it's changed the lives of kids. And I think that it is very difficult for people to put any kind of a limitation on the use of devices and social media at home. And I am concerned about that. I understand its power as an educational tool, but I also think that it has opened up a lot of challenges for kids in terms of how they use it. There's an article in The Atlantic this month about the elevation of depression and anxiety among children because they are on their devices 24/7. They sleep with their phones. And this is the smartphone generation, and I think that it is important for the schools to offer at least guidelines. You know, we have no say over what happens when the children leave us. We can manage the use of devices in the schools, but I think that we would do the kids a disservice if we did not make significant recommendations about how those devices should be used at home, or at least about the careful access. I think we have a problem if kids are sleeping with their phones. I think there need to be safe places for children. And I think that as a school board, we should provide some thoughtful suggestions. I don't know that there's much else we can do, but I think as people in charge of educating kids, that is something that we should take seriously. And I would like us as a board to be considering suggestions that we might offer for the safe and careful use of devices by kids. You don't like to see kids addicted to using their devices. You don't like to see them in a situation where they feel like they can't turn the phone off. I think kids need a safe place to be. And with the emergence of smartphones and constant access to them, it's a different world. And I think that it is an obligation of a thoughtful school board to be thinking about that.
I think some of the things we talked about in the retreat that come to mind, we're talking about individualized learning for children, especially playing to the children's strengths and setting the bar higher for them if they are strong in a certain subject, and then the ones that are weaker and still kind of setting that bar higher and not necessarily limiting the child based on the class they're in, but letting them advance as far as they're actually capable, they're capable of doing. So something that we actually do a great job of here, but I think there's like more work and more growth that we can do in that area. There are many kids that have different gifts, and so if we can just try to like focus in on that and just enable them to grow whatever they're strongest in, I think that's one thing we can work towards. And I think that it helped with.
So once a kid's in the track isn't sort of the ATP track. Try to find ways to pump them up.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Or if they're, strong in one thing but not the other, but, still push them to be, the best they can in that particular field. And that would probably help that would help down the road. So you're talking about leveling the playing field and getting rid of that gap.
So I would just add, sort of tying in with you said about equity and Barbara, what you were saying about technology and being thoughtful about how we deploy it. I would like us to be seen as thought leaders in our community, similar to what we did with our equity town hall, more things like that where we bring things to our community, whether it's around curriculum or instruction. We're looking at UDL now, which is a different way of thinking about how to teach kids, which might address some of the things that you're talking about, Nicole. But, how can we have a conversation with parents about social media, in a way that opens all of our eyes to different ways to how we can work with our children in a way that makes sense. It's not leaving us. Instagram is not going to go away, and if it does, it'll be something else. So how can we, as a board, lead that conversation and look, you know, 5-10 years down the line and bring the community with us?
I think one of the challenges of an environment like this is sometimes the policies lag behind what's actually happening on the ground. And I know that Mr. Garski and the team at Roosevelt have been busy implementing policies that ways to address some of the issues that they've seen. For instance, I remember just recently something came home through the Bulldog Bulletin about how they're not allowing children to use phones in between classes. They're allowed to have them at school, but they must remain out of the classroom. So I think that kind of dovetails into what you were saying about how kids are just addicted to the use of these things. I've been working with PTO at Roosevelt to come up with some strategies, just because it's my interest as well, not as a board member, but as a parent, to empower parents to become, to take action about the issues that the devices that we use every day, plus anything that may be coming home, you know, coming from the own home. So we've come up with a few ideas, and we're working right now to come up with some programming. And in talking with Rich a little bit about this, it's parent to parent, and he's also a high school administrator, so he sees this as well. He came up with some ideas that kind of go into what was suggested at the retreat about possibly doing a town hall forum with the other districts in the area to encourage conversation around these matters.
I think going back to the thought leader, and here's the issue, let's be thought leaders, let's get together with people who have the resources, which you and others have done with the PTO, and really have an action and a date, because we have lots of great ideas and lots of great thinking behind it, but can we get people to the table? Can we get people, you know, in front of us? The people who need to be in front of the parents. Me too.
I was intended legacy, diversity, whether it's ethnic, economic, or social diversity, from the top all the way to the bottom, the school board, the teachers, administration, staff, students. And let's by no means just take people to be diverse, but let's go out and find quality people, and let's make quality students of, you know, every background.
So I think I'm going to try to process all this, and I think I'll work with Ed in the next couple of weeks over coming up with maybe agenda items that we can work around the vision to make sure that the board is actually working and all this stuff, and that we can translate it to policy. And I to the extent that we can, right? Some of the stuff we can't, but some we can. And I think we do have some action items on this idea around a community forum, town hall forum, on device utilization and that kind of thing. And I do think it would be smart to collaborate with these 97 and 200 on that if we can. So we should reach out to them. I'll reach out to the folks on the equity committees on that and bring it back to their board. I did report back that we have met, so we do have a number of things. And then maybe we should create a board-driven agenda item for consideration around what we're working on these various topics, the thought leader stuff, the town hall forum. Ed, do we have a planned series of dates for our next town hall forum?
We have some proposed agenda items and town hall forums for the CAL meetings, so of course, the next year. I think the Education Committee is going to meet sometime in the next week or so to try and finalize that and bring it forward to the board. But But I think tentatively, it's either December, I think the proposed dates are for town halls are December, March, April. I had, trying to do it from memory, I'm sorry. But anyway, we'll bring that forward with the recommendation from the equity committee fairly soon.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And I think the way that we make sure that we hold ourselves as board members accountable for trying to move our board in the direction where we could realize some of this, this vision for our school district, which I think is realizable, is to eventually translate it into agenda items and move on, right? So that would be my hope and goal. If we need a follow-up discussion, maybe in, maybe not at the next COW, but the one after that, to see if we've made progress, to just note it on here, follow-up discussion item, and I think I would add that to the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And let's start doing that every other COW, just to make sure that we're actually moving forward, we're not just talking, okay? Ed, that takes us to the superintendent's report.
Yes, so actually, this is an action item. I know the board was hoping to kind of finalize their board committee assignments tonight. And the last meeting, you know, Rich was appointed as the personnel committee chair, but that left a couple of other items kind of still to be finalized.
Right. So the proposed slate, it's included in your board packets. Communications would be Barb Hickey, Education Nicole Thompson, Equity Martiri, Facilities Judy Theogracius, Finance Cal Davis, Personnel Rich Moore, Policy Stacy Williams, and not here because it's not a committee, but of course the Inclusive Advisory Board. I believe that's you, right, Stacy? Do you have a co-chair with that since Anna's gone, or do you want a co-chair?
No, it's okay. Just me.
I'm just noting that. So if that slate is okay, I would like someone to propose that we adopt that as a slate of committee chairs going forward.
So moved.
Second.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Mrs. DeGracias?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mr. Martiri?
Yep.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Dr. Thompson?
Yes.
Ms. Williams?
Yes.
Okay, so just one other brief announcement. I probably should have done this during the opening, but I'm going to do it now. Since we're about to go into an education committee, anyone that didn't follow it, something historic happened in the state of Illinois last week. The governor signed 1947 into law on Wednesday of last week. And just to put it in perspective, when the people of Illinois woke up Wednesday morning last week, they woke up in the state that had the single worst school funding formula in America, least equitable, least adequate. When they went to bed, they went into bed in the state that had the best school funding formula in all of America. That is a historic change. It's going to require some investment to make it a reality. The way the law is written, an additional $350 million will be going into education over and above what went in prior years every year until such time as on an inflation-adjusted basis. In today's dollars, an additional $6.2 billion will be invested in K-12 education across the state of Illinois. The money will go first to those school districts that are furthest away from having an adequate amount of resources to meet the educational needs of their children, predicated on what the evidence suggests they do need for their children to succeed academically. You know, in Illinois, you just don't expect that. And nonetheless, it did happen. So big things are happening in the state of Illinois, and I'm very personally excited about it. I'm not gonna be able to make the Ed Red meeting.
On Friday.
You're going to be there?
I'll be there. Sure.
It'll be interesting to hear how they talk about it. Ed Red opposed 1947. I can't make it because it's my board meeting for CTBA, or I would be there,
okay,
maybe asking questions about that.
Most likely.
Yes.
Ralph, since you brought that up, I mean, can you speak a little bit about how it might affect District 90? This year, next year?
It won't. So we're a tier four school. So basically,
people want to know.
Yeah, so basically here's how it works. Because we're $6 billion below adequacy and the state has a $15 billion accumulated deficit and it only raised $5 billion in new tax revenue this year, you could do the math. It doesn't quite have the number to fully fund adequacy for the entire state in the near future. So school districts are divided into four tiers under the legislation. Tier four school districts have over 100% of what the evidence indicates they need to educate their children today based on their combination of state contribution in and what they should be raising from their local resources. River Forest District 90 is tier 4. We have over 100% of the resources. Tier 3 is between 90 and 100% of the resources. Tier 2 is between 64 and 90%. And tier 1 is less than 64%. Now the adequacy target, and I'll just do 2 seconds on that, but you've got to know it to understand. So the evidence-based model developed at the Universities of Wisconsin and USC basically says, here are those educational practices over the last 30 years that have had a statistically meaningful correlation to enhancing student achievement. So we're going to fund those. So there's no longer a state foundation level like we're used to, a dollar amount per kid. Every school district has its own unique adequacy target of funding it needs to implement these best practices. There are 27 of them. They're itemized in the bill. And so the way it would work, so for a middle school, we're a middle school, just to show how it would work. For every 142 children in attending your middle school, the model would fund one full-time equivalent teacher for every one of your core subjects and art, those kinds of things. Then for every 125 low-income students in your school, you'd get another full-time equivalent teacher funded for each core subject. And that low-income child counted twice, once in your base population and once as a low-income kid. And then for every 125 English language learners, you get another full-time equivalent teacher in each core subject. And if that English language learner happens to be low income, that child counts 3 times. So you can see built up resources for those districts that serve a disproportionate number of low income and EL children. It also includes things like school psychologists, guidance counselors, tier 2 interventionalists, enrichment programs, literally all the stuff, evidence-based professional development. It's all covered, and so if you look at the 27 mental. So you get this unique adequacy target, right? Of the, every school district will get, in this year, its base funding minimum, and that is everything they got from the state in 2017. So no school district loses money. So we get exactly what we got in 2017, again, from the state. Then the tiers of schools will share the $350 million new money as follows. 50% of the $350 million goes to Tier 1 schools. The next 49% of the $350 million is shared among Tier 1 and Tier 2. Tier 3 gets 0.9% of the new money.
To Tier 4.
We are Tier 4. We share in 0.1% of the new money. So we're basically held harmless at prior funding levels. And you know, that's how it should be, frankly. We do have the resources. We are just fine. But the design of the legislation is to move those school districts that are furthest away from adequacy up fastest, right? So they get the resources to implement these best practices. And why the 90 to 100% is the cutoff for 0.9%, this funding formula doesn't include any federal funds. So it's just looking at your combined state and local resources. So if between state and local resources, you're at 90% of your adequacy target, the feds cover roughly 10% of funding statewide. So you're gonna be somewhere above 95% in reality. So you're pretty much at adequacy. So it's really looking at those school districts that are below adequacy. So that's how it works.
So I have a question.
Yep.
At the university, the universities who came up with this formula of what needs to happen in order for the school districts to succeed, and they're going to get these things funded. What if they don't implement what are on the agenda, what that model says?
So the accountability metrics obviously aren't in the funding formula. It's just a funding formula. The accountability metrics are being developed under ESSA, and ESSA has an equity lens. Our ESSA plan was just approved. We included that in our packets. The final accountability matrix has yet to be developed. However, it will look something like a performance budget at the end of the day. So here's what will happen, I hope. But this is in conversations with the State Board of Education and the Secretary of Education for the state. So there will be outcomes that'll be your horizontal axis that there were hopeful school districts will achieve. And not just test scores, right? Dropout rates, graduation rates, reduced disciplinary problems. I mean, there's a lot of outcomes that matter in education. So here are your outcomes bar. And then your utilization as a school district, you have to report how you apply your resources to the outcome fund. Now your base funding minimum, that's tied into your existing practices. So you can't really do much with that. So what you're really gonna be reporting is how you're applying your new money to accomplish these outcomes. And what's brilliant about having the evidence-based model as the matrix to compare your spending to, we have effect sizes, statistically meaningful effect sizes for the different practices. Some are much greater than others. So we are going to look for school districts to apply their resources to the most positive, statistically meaningful effect size practices first, because they're not going to be fully funded. And that will move the needle for us. And if they don't, everyone will know. Their voters will know, their locals will know, the state board will know. So the idea is to create a new accountability matrix that's informative and allows for continuous improvement. So a school district, let's take a school district that's in the tier one, so it's got 64% or less of the resources it needs to adequately educate its kids. Even after this first tranche of funding, it's not gonna move the needle. Maybe it'll have 65, 66%, right? Maybe it'll move up a little bit. So it's not gonna be able to move the needle on all those things, but we do wanna see them apply their new resources to the highest effect size best practice.
Thank you.
Sure.
Well, we'd be remiss not to ask after a grandiloquent statement like that, you know, what's the meat and potatoes of it? And so thank you for your understanding of it. Anthony, I know you've been watching it too. I know a little bit about it. And,
yeah,
but it also has changed all year, so these details in there have kind of changed until they finally signed it into law. Who knew what we were going to get? So thank you for following.
And certainly there were other elements that came along with it that have garnered a lot of attention. But if it seems to those of you in the audience that Ralph seems to know a lot about this, it's not only because he was part of the commission that established the concept here in Illinois and tried to make it actionable, but I know he was highly influential in helping the legislation move through. And there are many, many school districts statewide, including ours, of course, that are very grateful for the passage of this legislation and what it means for the future of the state. So
hopefully
a lot to
celebrate. Yeah. In Illinois, man, you get a win in education, you take it. You know, it's early. So, Rich.
All right. Well, a lot going on at the state level, a lot going on at the district level, a lot going on, you know, administratively. We all want to know what our kids are learning tomorrow in class and what our teacher, how we are supporting our teachers to improve and make sure that our kids are getting the best education in the world. So I'm going to defer to Dr. Holly here. What's going on?
Looks like it's
going on. What's
this
not going on?
So board members can look to page 8 to kind of start the initial portion of this presentation, and then Allison's going to talk.
I won't turn off the lights until then.
Allison's going to talk just a little bit about some of the initiatives at the curriculum office, which, as Rich said, are about the most important relationship, which is the relationship between the teacher and the student, after all. And then, of course, we'll be discussing the kids' survey, so a lot to talk about.
So in the memo, I just highlighted broad brushstrokes in terms of the goals and the initiatives that we're going to be running this year. We're going to continue with math. We have a K-5 implementation plan for the recently adopted investigations materials. We did a full-scale 4-day training of almost every teacher in the district, except for just a handful. And when they returned, they received training as well in the spring, in August. So we have an implementation plan that we'll be monitoring and supporting with professional development across the year for K-5. Grades 6 and 7, we extended the math pilot for this year for the grades 6, 7, and 8, simply because we wanted to gather more data points before making such major decisions. So that is up and running. We are continuing with the Pearson System of Courses and Connected Math Project 3. So once that data is gathered, we hope to have it all by November and a recommendation to the school board by December. In the second half of the school year. The past couple years, we've had a K-4 writing committee. We have repurposed it this year. It's now a K literacy committee. We've been expanding our writing initiative onto additional grades. So fifth grade this year is diving in full force with the writing initiative and starting to look at how reading and writing mesh together. So the literacy committee is gonna look at, much like we created a vision for the math, mathematics education in D90, we're gonna do the same for literacy. So we're gonna look at balanced literacy and make sure we have a clear vision for that. And that will guide future decision making for going forward for looking at literacy. We're starting to look at the diversity of book selections we have in our classroom libraries. A degree of inventorying of what we have. We did receive some new sets of books last week. So we're gonna start digging into that. I'm sure we'll report back with the literacy committee later in the year. Science is in year two of their implementation of iQuest. Initially they wanted to implement performance-based assessments to go with the units. So they have three units across every grade. At the end of every unit, they're gonna have a hands-on real-world performance-based task that they'll be developing as individuals and in small groups. So they're looking for defined STEM is helping us do that. I'll receive professional development across the year on that. We're very excited. Social studies has requested that we start a review with them to incorporate the 3C framework into their work. So we're gonna start with looking at overarching essential questions. The whole idea of the 3C framework is really to engage students in more inquiry-based learning around social studies. So we're gonna do some investigation into essential questions, not only unit-based essential questions, but also overarching essential questions as we look at all of our disciplines, not just social studies, K through eighth. The idea being is a result of our students being with us since kindergarten, first grade, through eighth grade. What skills do we hope our students are able to carry away with them in the different disciplines that they are spending time on? So, now those are just curriculum committees, but we also have other district level committees. So we're diving into universal design for learning this year, and really this is a learning year for us. So we're gonna spend time building some capacity within the universal design for learning committee, which will then create some turnkey experiences for people at the building level. And hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have some ideas of goals and targets that we wanna look at for several years going forward, because it's an initiative that does take a lot of time and care and many years to reach full implementation. So we want to get the groundwork set for that this year. SLC continues with standards-based reporting. I think that covers just about all of it. Happy to take any questions if you have any.
In social studies, are they incorporating the document-based question? I saw some of that happening at the eighth grade level. That
is a current practice. It's something that we'll look at. I think part of it is we've got the current scope and sequence that we want to take a look at closely. We want to reaffirm what we have. We want to see how it connects to K-4. And then, yeah, what are the different ways we want to resource something? I think document-based questions are something that could be incorporated into that. I know that the department chair over there brought that up as an interest of hers. They're also interested in looking at more flexible resources. So the education world in some disciplines is moving towards tech books, which is online streaming of different resources. So instead of adopting a hardcover book that you traditionally do that falls apart after 6 years and that's why you start a review all over again, is tech books are more dynamic. So content can be refreshed and redeveloped over time by whatever vendor you use. Discovery Education is one of them that I think they're interested in looking at. So that offers lot in terms of what you're able to access, and video streaming and text and primary source documents. So there's a lot of great stuff out there that we can take a look at. So
what are you doing with your free time? Of which there is none.
There's some.
Not much. Well, the organization, and I think not to facilitate your transition
no, okay.
to the next
Feel
topic,
free.
But the organization and I think particularly alignment that you and the principals and our educational leaders, instructional specialists are bringing, I think, to this process is what's really been significant in helping move it all forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'm standing up here by myself today, but honestly, I mean, all the building principals and the instructional facilitators and the tech facilitators and the teachers, and it really is a collaborative effort to make this engine go, and looking forward to another good year. We did a lot last year, so plenty of building. Well,
and part of it will
speaking
be
of building,
the kids.
Yeah, so I'm here to give a brief overview of the kindergarten individualized developmental survey. This was originally introduced by ISBE, I think in 2014. It's been piloted across many school districts across the state. It's been revised from its original iteration, which to say it was quite extensive. It's been scaled back, and districts now have options for how they can approach or implement this assessment, and I'll share that with you this evening. As I mentioned before, it's intended to assess a child's developmental readiness when they enter into kindergarten in the public schools. It's aligned to the Illinois Early Learning Standards and Illinois Early Learning Standards for Kindergarten. The assessment consists of a series of domains, and within each domain there are developmental progressions that students are assessed against. So this is not a situation where kindergarten students are placed in a testing environment or they're asked to do anything related to the test. This is teacher observation. So KidsTech is the app that teachers will use that they can walk around and make observational assessments of their students. It is intended to be administered on the 40th day of school, so for us that is October 20th. However, you have a 7-day window on either side to assess the students, so that gives us, I believe, October 11th through October 31st. But I would not recommend Halloween as an assessment day for our students. We'd like to be done well before that. So, as I mentioned before, it's teacher observation. Levels are organized into different categories. So students are either assessed as early, middle, or late in the building phase, or they are early, middle, or late in the integration phase. As I mentioned before, the Kids app is how they capture all of the information. It is a secure online system, so I believe that certainly speaks to our student privacy policy and making sure we protect their information, and it's encrypted, sure, for only the state to be able to see and to review. There are three different options for this assessment. So the minimum requirements is the one is the 14 state readiness measures. It is a measure across four different domains, which include approaches to learning and self-regulation, social emotional development, language and literacy, and cognition math. It's the state minimum requirement. I'll have a more complete chart of this on the next slide that I show you. The second option is 5 aligned domains per school readiness, which has 29 measures, an increase from 14, and it adds an additional domain, which is physical development. The third option is the 11 kids domains of readiness, and that represents full alignment to the Illinois Early Learning Standards for students. It includes the following, in addition to the 5 previous domains that I mentioned, cognition science, health, history, social sciences, visual and performing arts, English language development, and language and literacy development in Spanish for a total of 55 measures. That actually was the original kids assessment that was proposed, but I believe after feedback from districts, it has been reduced or scaled back to a degree where people have choices. Yes.
What's the capacity of the observing teachers to accurately?
Well, I would say the first iteration was demanding to be diplomatic about it. But no, it's a lot. It's asking a lot. There's a lot of observational assessment that we do of our students, and we have a pretty robust assessment portfolio in place already that this is.
But if you don't have training in early childhood development and brain development, so do you need professional development to actually be able to do the assessment?
Yes, you do. So this rolled out towards the end of July. We have teachers that are going to training on September 7th, so that's about 3 days from now. We're running the
as fast as we can on this one, given that we had new assignments in kindergarten this year. So teachers had not, you cannot get a Kids Tech login until you've been officially trained by the state. So when you complete the state training, the state releases a login to the teachers. And it was tough to find options that would work for us because we have new assignments. The information came out in late July, so we've got three kindergarten teachers going to training on the 7th. And then David managed to squeeze in his, on the very last administrative training right after he joined us, so thank you for being so flexible. But otherwise, Diane and the other trainer, or the other kindergarten teachers have been trained before, and I was trained in my previous role in my previous district. So I'm looking forward to what they bring back to see how the training differs from the previous one that I experienced. And we'll sit down immediately and start going through the different rubrics and how it's going to work on the iPad. So we are going to opt for the minimum requirement, not because we're slackers, but because we do have a robust assessment portfolio already, and we want to make sure that we are using the data in a way that is most relevant for students. So when we're looking at the different criteria across the domains, what teachers are looking to observe are curiosity of students, resilience, engagement, persistence. Looking at their social relationships, how do they relate to adults, how do they relate to one another, looking at their language and literacy development, which we know is key in early childhood and certainly in kindergarten. Can they have reciprocal language? How are they with their expressive language? And certainly they want to look at the early literacy characteristics of phonological awareness, letter and word recognition. When they're looking at math, when you look at classification, you're talking about can they put things into groups or classify things and objects together. Looking at number, sense, quantity, you're really talking about what's the difference between what is more, what is less, addition, subtraction, what does it mean to add to or take away, and then finally basic shapes. Can kids identify basic shapes? That really does sort of, I guess it summarizes it well, but how that looks in action, we'll see. So, as far as next steps go, we ensure that all the teachers and relevant administrators are being trained. We need to confirm that all the Kids Tech logins are operational. We also have that back of the house set up that we need to ensure that we have going. And then certainly, top of the list, should have been the first bullet point, is we provide communication to kindergarten families so that the assessment is forthcoming. I'm happy to take any questions. Well, that's an excellent question. I may have skipped a slide because I have one about. Okay, so those are the domains. Sorry, I skipped over a slide. So ideally, we'll see. But ideally, it's going to produce individual reports for students. It'll give classroom reports for teachers. Districts will have their district level and school level reports, and then the state will certainly have their aggregated data across the state and statewide summaries to make the reference. So, what will the state do with it? That's a good question. I'm still waiting on the 2016 science results. So I think there's a little bit of a lag, and I think just because of where we were with other things going on in the state that kids came out late probably because of that. So I think it's gonna be a work in progress. I know that it's well-intentioned. I think the overarching goal is to make sure that the kids are ready when they come to us. For our purposes, we are doing it one time a year in October, so it's not so much about how are we supporting the developmental trajectory of our kindergarten students, is really how ready are they when they are coming in, and maybe how do we communicate that level of readiness back to early childhood programs or use that information with our partnerships across River Forest. So that's potentially a possibility, so we'll see.
So will it provide any data that's actionable as those particular kids move forward through elementary school?
That I would hope. I think anytime you're looking at a developmental continuum, essentially what this is because you've got the two categories and it's designed to have progressions, I think you'll be able to see here's where the child is and here's what's next as you look down the developmental progression. So I think it can certainly provide a benchmark for students, and as they look ahead across the progression of skills, this is the trajectory you can expect this child to take or a trajectory you want to move them along. We'll have to see what the final K-12 Kids Tech app looks like in terms of how it portrays that data and what it really sends back. To the extent that a full kids report might make suggestions or how that final report is going to interpret the data that gets sent in, I'm curious. I'd like to see what that sample report looks like. So, but we're hopeful. It'll be helpful to us.
Well, and Allison, you did a great job covering the waterfront on this. One thing that we did want to share for folks again in attendance is that our kindergartners, particularly our experienced kindergarten teachers, have exposure to this. District 90 was selected, 4 years ago as a pilot site for the original kids, and we've been doing different elements of it in different ways over the course of the last 3 years. But this represents the first time that District 90 will be doing it, soup to nuts, obviously in compliance with the state mandate about how it needs to look, and the formal training, and all of those elements. And, it will give us one more piece of data about our kids, and this, I think, will be a nice complement to another survey that our families of rising kindergartners will be doing this year, or they're now current kindergartners, called the Ages and Stages Questionnaire, which is a social-emotional observational tool that parents are going to be doing. It has a huge kind of statistical database of decades of participants. It's been revised, of course, numerous times over the years, but the entire purpose is to aggregate data and try to use it as kind of a general benchmark for where kids should be in their foundational skills and their development over time. And it helps us to see kids that maybe are outliers and then try to define what those unique combinations and needs might be that we could supplement so that kids are starting with their best foot forward in their early years. So hats off to our teachers, our kindergarten teachers, both our veteran kindergarten teachers. We have some, as Allison mentioned, we have some
teachers.
They're
all very experienced. Like, I have every confidence in the kindergarten
Absolutely.
Teachers. I don't see them struggling with the concept or the application. I think it's just, to what degree or what extent is this going to impact their teaching time.
Right. But the folks who are newer to kindergarten, although those are experienced teachers in D92, they didn't have as much ramp-up time for training, and so we laud them on getting that under
the
belt.
They were fabulous. They were on it, very flexible, and they're a phenomenal team. They really are.
They really
so
are fortunate.
If anybody can knock this out in a short period of time, it's definitely them. So.
It would be interesting to see, as we learn what the data tells us, mm-hmm. if it does paint a picture for how ready kids are when they come to us, if you would be able to look back and say, okay, based on what a child did from 3 to 5, how ready are they when they come in the front door? Mm-hmm. And what does that tell us about how we can, like you said, reach back to early childhood in the community and have that conversation.
Yeah, it could be a communication tool for that. So
right.
We'll see what the final reports look like.
Thank
okay,
you so much.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate it.
And it moves us to Ms. Diagracius and the facilities report.
Yes. Well, I have the unique pleasure of chairing the facilities committee. And one of the reasons why I really wanted to do it was because I like construction and fixing just personally. I think it's interesting. And I also get to work with Anthony. So, who knows everything about every project that's been done in District 90 for the past, 17 years? Is that a fair assessment?
That's a fair assessment.
Okay.
He not only knows where skeletons are buried, he buried most of them.
So let's all stay on Anthony's good side. So I guess I can turn this over to you, right?
Sure. In your packet, you'll see a memo that was originally discussed at the board retreat. So it talks about a conceptual scheme for a potential Willard classroom addition on the second floor, knowing that there are some space issues that have are being experienced currently at Willard School this year. I'll go over the concept in scheme number 2 here in your packet, once again, where it shows putting an addition over the 1997 addition at the north end of the building. On the first floor, there's the two classrooms. So this has a little additional space. And by no means is any of this anything more than just an idea of what could happen if you chose to pursue alleviating some of the space issues by doing this. This could be two classrooms on the second floor. It could be, as shown, two smaller classrooms with a multi-purpose room and then several offices. None of this is anything more than just an idea of what the interior walls could have if you went this way. Really, all you're restricted by in this scenario is the exterior walls. So on the A2.0 classroom scheme shows where interior walls could be if you placed that second floor on top of the first floor, knowing that you have some ability to put some offices, what is currently over the instructional specialist and a supply room on one end, as well as the exterior going out that doorway onto Franklin Street exit. On pages A2.1 through 2.3 gives you an idea of, under this concept, how the roof line, the elevation would be on the exterior, knowing that this concept does not show extending attic space, but just having a flat roof like it is currently on the first floor to the second floor. Being careful to understand that Willard School is a historical landmark in the village, and you will have to do some work, as you did when you did the Willard School project, Willard window project several years ago, working with the River Forest Landmark Commission to gain their feedback on how you would incorporate this addition into the existing framework of the building. This concept shows keeping the stone cornice the same across, but not extending the attic and having slate roof as it is on the rest of the building, except this northern end as it is now on the first floor. What we've provided you after those schemes is a way to understand the in some written language as well as some photo illustrations of the impact, that is the number of students impacted in these areas. Knowing full well that Willard, as of the date of this memo, had 368 students in its enrollment, and knowing that in 1718, fourth section of fourth grade was added, a fourth section of kindergarten was added, and another section of the inclusion preschool was added, as well as in the prior year in 1617, a fourth section of first grade was added. So those things, together with some unique programming, caused what we can call somewhat of a space issue. So on the first page in those illustrations, you'll see a skills program that impacts 12 students, which was in a much larger classroom that had a bathroom in the classroom and had to be moved to a smaller room and the adjacent conference room. So every time I say something of something that moves somewhere, something was existing there to begin with, so that had to move out somewhere else, so this kind of domino effect. So the skills program moving to a smaller room, or E1, and then the adjacent conference room, and E1 doesn't have a bathroom, so you have a smaller room, a conference room that's being affected, as well as no bathroom, and there are many reasons how these 12 students are impacted. Onto the next page, you'll see that STEM, which had for the past few years a dedicated classroom in which, in this year, having to move to the Library Learning Center. Well, 342 of the 368 students have a STEM class, so they are impacted, as well as the fact that it's being moved into a section of the Library Learning Center. 368 students have access to the library throughout the day, and have teaching in there. So we can say that 368 students are impacted by the fact that the library is now smaller. And you can see the picture of where STEM is being placed in the LLC and how that section in that corner is being moved out from the library. The next page, the inclusion preschool, skills, and special ed resource is being utilized in the first floor hallway of the West Wing. in which we could say that 40 students are directly impacted with this, these manipulatives and other things that are being used in those sections are in the hallway, with 100 students. Yes. One long hallway.
That's our classroom.
100 students are indirectly affected by people being in that hallway, and those people in those students in those three classrooms are being affected by some distractions that are going on in the hallway. The bottom picture showing the photo from the west, but you can see the door that's open there is actually the occupational therapy, for lack of a better term, room. It's a very large closet, I guess we can say.
You want to call it the occupational therapy cubby.
That's right. The next page, or page 27, the school psychologist is located in the second floor elevator landing, in which we can say that 50 students are directly impacted by her being there. She's the site facilitator, and also all students, 368, are impacted through the fact that she gives GPS, IPS, CPI, and other services to all those students. But you can see a desk, a chair, file cabinet, all there at the top of that elevator landing, in which obviously some disabled and other mobility challenged students have to use that elevator as well. And you can see it from the second picture on the bottom there, where the elevator door would open up right into where someone is sitting.
So we can assume significant privacy issues.
Definitely, right? Privacy issues are an issue in that one. The next page, you'll see the special education resource class, which came from a normal size classroom and moved to the LLC computer lab. So as I said before about STEM taking a section of the LLC, well, this has taken another section of the LLC inside the computer lab. Now that was available because that computer lab wasn't going to be used as a computer lab anymore, but we can say that 11 students are impacted. The size of the class that they came from was much larger than this, as you can see how condensed this room is in the photos you see there. Just outside that computer lab is where the instructional technology specialist and the tech support employee sit in the LLC entranceway, in which they are right in the main entrance to the Library Learning Center. This could impact anywhere from 90 to 368 students on a daily basis as they're walking through these two employees' places to sit. The MTSS intervention aid has set up in two separate areas throughout in the building, one at the top end, as you'll see in later sections, but here at the first floor elevator behind it, actually, in which she has some pull-out support. So she has set up a nice little area right at the bottom of the elevator landing behind it and underneath the stairs.
Basically a hallway.
Basically a underneath the elevator shaft.
Hallway, yeah.
And I will say in a couple of these areas, it's been noted by the Regional Office of Education that things shouldn't be clustered in these areas, but we do what we can to make as much of the space. Possible.
Big nasty electrical switch right there, yeah. Next to the.
You're correct. The other place that the MTSS intervention aid, as well as some occupational therapy employees, are in the second floor hallway, and once again, hallway. And this has also been an area that the Regional Office of Education has cited as being something where you need a certain amount of space in a hallway for egress during fire evacuation and other egress times. So this is an area that we'd like you to see that is inhibiting on that. So this is 30 students are impacted directly, but other students impacted as they are walking through the hallway. The new assistant principal his office space is being shared with what is now the new conference room. As you heard before, the conference room was moved out of the other area into this room, which actually used to be a special ed resource, and so this is now a shared space with very little privacy for any type of meetings going on there or the assistant principal's work. So because both of those functions could have indirectly impact students, all students, we threw 368 students on here as well. the instructional specialist, and this is on the first floor. As you, as I mentioned, she is right in front of a storage area, as well as run in front of what we call the pump room. And that's not a restaurant in downtown Chicago. That is an actual pump in a room. She is meets with students in there, so she indirectly impacts all 38 students in her role, but is essentially in a the anterior room of a storage area. And then lastly, special education aides work in that foyer by door 8. 20 students are directly or indirectly impacted. This is setting up for teachers to help support students and work and provide interventions, and that is right there in the hallway by the exit door.
So, obviously, Anthony worked hard, and also Principal Boyd worked hard, I know, to gather some illustrative, I think, evidence of some of the challenges that we're experiencing at the school. As the board is aware, enrollment's about 30 students or so more than was anticipated this year, after having just done a geodemographic study this spring.
How many years has it been off point?
That's a great question. So the geodemographic studies that we normally contract are for 10 years. We found historically that outside of 5, they become questionably accurate. The last couple that we have contracted through an outstanding geodemographer with outstanding references and has done some very high quality work for us in the past, for some reason have been less accurate than we would have wished. Enrollment at Willard has been slightly higher than was anticipated for the last 3 years. This year at both elementary schools we saw a significant jump. The difference is that at Lincoln they were able to manage that pretty comfortably. One of the interesting nuances, too, about enrollment is that while this sounds, I don't even know what the best adjective is to describe it, it sounds like it would be hard to believe, but the impact of enrollment all depends upon where it happens and how it happens. So if you get significant enrollment increases at certain grade levels where maybe it's high already, you know, it can have a much more significant impact, requiring a full section, for example, where maybe that wouldn't have been necessary if you saw an even larger enrollment increase where enrollment is down. It has an inconsistent impact across the school, depending upon where the students come from and upon the needs that they have. One of the things that I think is most significant about the photos that the board has received showing locations where students are receiving services that are unusual is that the lion's share of students that receive many of those ancillary services are some of our more vulnerable students, students that are receiving special education services, physical therapy, in many cases remediation interventions. These are students that the district is working really hard and teachers are working really hard to support and bring up to, you know, levels of success. And so that's, I think, one of the challenges. The good news, and there's a lot of good news, of course, but some of the good news here is that the reason we have specialists providing these high-quality services for kids to help them make that progress is the resources the district can, you know, has leveraged to ensure that we have adequate staff. But when our schools were built, you know, these are the schools we have, as we know, in River Forest, and so we need to make them last far into the future. And when these schools were built, classes were taught in a very traditional format, 30 children, one teacher, and that's how we ran school. But obviously the number of specialists and the way in which we provide programming today is markedly different than it was when Willard was built in 1929. And while Diane and certainly Anthony team have worked very hard, I think, to try to get the most of the space. It is not optimal by any means. So my understanding, I think, mainly from the board retreat was that the board had hoped we would bring more information back, a little bit more illustrative information, so that you all could provide consensus tonight about whether you wished for us to proceed in securing some more formal architect's renderings and estimates for what recommended minimal amount of construction would look like based upon kind of generally what's out there.
Would the classrooms be the same, bigger or smaller on size? Willer has some different size classrooms, so are these on the bigger side or the smaller side?
The ones you see in this concept are on the average side.
Average size, or in the middle.
You could say there are some older classrooms that are a little smaller, and then you have those ones that were built in 1997 on the first floor that are much larger. Mm-hmm. And since this is right over that area, knowing that it's probably not the most optimal use of space to have 1,150 square foot classrooms like on the first floor. This is why this one scheme that we've brought you shows them at a little bit smaller than that, around the 800 square foot area.
Okay, so the multi-purpose room in theory could be a classroom, just a small one.
Yes, a flexible meeting space.
Okay.
You could increase it a little bit. But not much, or you could make it much smaller and make it a large office and make the classrooms a little bigger. Like I said, those walls in all those areas can move in multiple different directions to create different size offices, different size classrooms.
It sounds like the existing facilities are impairing instruction, they're impairing support, and they are questionable from a safety standpoint. Do I have this understood relatively well?
I think those pictures show that, I guess the...
I'd emphasize the first two.
Yeah.
The Regional Office of Education, while they don't like to see some of the ways we've configured the buildings, that our facilities are fully safe, but they're not optimal. And I'm sure they are impacting the quality of the instruction of the children that are receiving some of those buildings.
Can we ask Diane? I see you sitting there. Obviously, you're the one who has to manage all of this every single day.
Yes.
Did you want to add anything to give us a little more insight into how this practically affects you every day as you're making decisions about what the kids are doing?
I'd like to commend the Willard staff because they've really tried to make the spaces that they have as engaging as possible and safe while still creating good flow, but it's really tight teaching quarters. And as Ed said, our most vulnerable and potentially fragile, but those that have our greatest needs are in those public spaces, which is an issue for two reasons. One, they're the most easily distracted and need the greatest attention, but it's also a very public space to be working with getting help and working in terms of the therapies and such. Having the self-contained special education programs, while all children benefit from sensory, motor, and gross motor opportunities, that they have a sensory space. The past 4 years, our staff has been asking for a dedicated space that's not a hallway, that those kids can go and get the sensory and gross motor supports that they need. But a lot of our Gen Ed students, they visit those rooms to use those tools as well. They visit the hallways to use those rooms. So if there was a sensory room that all Willard kids, again, would be an equity and access, and we all benefit from that. I mean, you see me, I'm often the person who's sitting and doing this. I'm the one standing at a standing desk. We all benefit. So to create a space where that's a community space is positive and powerful. Splitting the skills room between two rooms is impacting resource for staff capacity and the possibility to differentiate learning and really meet those needs, how to best meet them split like that. And also impacts their membership. They're already a bit pulled out of their room and then their community is now split between two rooms. It's flexible throughout the day because they come and go through their rooms. But on, but it is really impacting the quality of our programming.
Mm-hmm.
As Ed said, no one is in danger, and the Willard staff has really pulled out all the stops to give kids what they need in the space they need, but we could do better.
Thank you.
So I guess I have a question for you too. How, if this were to happen, let's just say we had a magic wand.
We are the wizards.
That's true. How would it be configured? How would you use the space? What classrooms, what grades would go on the new space, and how would you utilize the space that is new because things got moved around?
Yeah, I don't have a definite plan, because part of that would be what my options might be based on what would be approved. Definitely the looking at state guidelines of how old children are that can be upstairs. The youngest ones can visit for art or visit for STEM, but I can't have first and second grade
right
on the second floor. So it would definitely need to be like a STEM space, the sensory room, things like that could be upstairs. And then the first floor would remain rooms that would be classrooms for primary students. Putting the skills classroom back perhaps where the room they used to be and have a bathroom in that bigger space. Or reconfiguring, you know, some of our space. It'd be great to give David space.
Yeah, and I guess that's where it's going to go with the question. Right along your line, I mean, if we are interested in saying, all right, it's a real problem, we need to add some space, at the same time, should we be reconfiguring some of the stuff on the first floor?
Possibly. Those two rooms are so huge.
Right.
That getting, so like our school psychologist, she should really be in a private space. And giving her impact could be greater if she could meet with children. Our social workers' caseload has gotten much larger. So again, if she were in a smaller space. Our instructional specialist, Anthony Fleming, and our tech specialist, Cindy Crandall, they are powerful teachers of staff and students. Whenever we do testing, whenever we do assessments, they're all hands on deck working with small groups and reteaching and supporting kids that they do in their space. But they also teach teachers, they mentor staff, they meet with stakeholders and parents, and they can't do that in the space they're in now. You know, we look forward at thinking of flexible teaching space and how furniture is used differently and walls and space are used differently and more flexible. If the first floor, those bigger rooms, could maybe be a different kind of wall, that could be a more flexible space with how we group children and share a push-in model with ELL or reading resource with a math specialist. If that wall were configured differently, or if there was a specialist between those rooms, and how teachers access that upstairs and downstairs. There's lots of creative ideas to place our specialists to have the greatest impact for students.
So if the board did indicate that there was consensus that we should go forward with asking the architect to provide more formal renderings, obviously, Diane, we need to be an important part of that process so that, you know, we can maximize our value. The administration is fully aware that, you know, this as a potential expenditure is significant. And the board for many years, of course, has been such a strong steward and continues to be of taxpayer dollars that we know that it's a significant expense for you to consider.
So would these changes solve all of these problems that we're seeing in these photographs?
Well, that was my next question is,
knowing,
I guess I would be interested in knowing that this would not only solve the problem that we have right now, but that we've looked at some of the various scenarios that could play out in the future, and I'm talking about not even just 5 years, but 10 years, mm-hmm. 15 years, that
certainly
we can, that this would be
that
the
this
answer.
Would be a long-lasting
right.
Correct.
Yeah.
Solution.
Correct.
Yeah.
That we're not just putting a Band-Aid on something that's, you know, really needs a different solution. Mm-hmm.
Depending upon how it's configured, it could do a number of different things. And like any other project, I think the district would want to pursue, we would want to make sure that, you know, the form follows function. So identify first, what are the goals that we're trying to accomplish? What's the vision? What are the goals? And then what's the best path forward? In fairness, I can't say that it would definitively solve all the problems for moving forward. Admittedly, we feel like this is probably a responsible request. In a perfect world, I'm not going to catch Diane's eye because I know she'd love to have four classrooms, four offices. Because from having been a school principal in the past, I can speak, you know, pretty confidently that the more flexibility you have, the more options you obviously can provide your staff and programming. So any principal would want to have as much space and options as possible. But knowing that we, you know, we're a landlocked village, there are some unknowns that are still, you know, in play, not necessarily Willard area, but there's some examples of development plans, I know, southern half of town. I mean, all of those things can move in ways that we don't predict. And, so I think it's a responsible request. I certainly couldn't say that it would solve all the problems, but is it fair to say Ms. Wood, that if we planned the use of this space very thoughtfully, that you could probably assure, or we could assure, that private student services would be provided in a private, appropriate way, and that we would have considerably more flexibility moving forward in case needs. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, and that gets back to my question about the first floor. So, I mean, if it needs to be extended to redoing part of the first floor at the same time, I mean, if we're going to go forward, I would like to have all these problems resolved. And if there's wasted space on that first floor because we're stuck with these really old giant classrooms, maybe that can be refigured with some of the new construction techniques to work. Maybe. I don't know. But, I'm
certainly
kind of
a question
with Judy,
worth
right?
asking.
I want to know that we solve problems when we spend the money.
Can we get a diagram of where everything is and where everything's going to be?
No. So, Diane, I'd like you to look into that.
Thanks.
One future issue might be global warming. Consider air conditioning.
That's a STEM project we're going to work on.
What about the
foreseeable
attic?
Future?
Anything is possible if you have the money to spend.
Oh, is that like plan C or D or something in the attic?
Anything is possible if you have the money to spend. Whatever you decide, if you decide to move forward at any time, knowing that this would be some summer project, knowing that advanced lead time on that is advantageous, as we have done in other years, work backwards from the last day of school in any one school year. It's a good practice, as we've done, to want to go out to bid on a job like this around Christmas. So, as you guys discuss this further, if you plan on doing this in summer of 18, think about getting some architectural renderings back to you after discussions with Ms. Wood in any in this fall, late fall, with the hopes of then taking it on the street around little after Thanksgiving, having be able to analyze that bid opening, and then having award that bid at or just after Christmas, so you have enough lead time. And you can also think, if you have to modify any future calendar, like we did in the summer of 12 when we did the Roosevelt interior project, to start a few days later, in that case a few weeks later. You want to think about it for more than that time, then just work backwards from whatever end of any school year you're talking about.
Just never say the words Roosevelt and project together again.
Notice how I said interior project. Much different from the other one.
I was just wondering, is there any way to project the number of students that we'll have next year? Like, if there's anything on the horizon, that there'll be an increase or a decrease?
Yes, we can certainly provide the geodemographic survey.
It'll be wrong.
Crystal ball not being available. Yeah.
No one has theirs. Okay.
Yeah, but I think an up or down of 15 or 20, 30 kids even won't make a difference in the problems that they've cited here. But I think that's a good question. But the I think the bigger question then, we've got to give some direction to the administration, is whether we want them to pursue a little bit more detailed look at this, with the thought of getting an architectural, at least rendering done of a couple of different options to see costs and how many of the problems are or are not solved, and whether or not it needs to involve the first floor. Are we interested in board and
yes,
having
absolutely.
Them pursue?
Yes.
And I like what Cal said, like where would this room be in the new scheme of things? Like
yeah.
how these things
how
move.
Would things shuffle around.
Yeah.
Yes.
We
can
provide
what, looks like.
Where it is, what does it look like in the new
we can provide you also at an upcoming meeting with the full schematics
yeah,
of the building so that you get a feel for how it's currently designed.
That'd be great.
Et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera,
but there's still look permit.
I'd like to go to walk.
Look into that because.
I did. Look at it as, look at it as it currently exists.
Things will be changed.
I did.
One thing I just want, as you move forward towards whatever consensus you, if you're going to pursue this.
You just got consensus.
Okay.
Stop opening the question.
All right, come on. Now that you have consensus in pursuing this, this plan that we are presenting here has the fixed exterior walls. If you, any of you remember back discussions about the space utilization study from 2009, there were many different concepts, but at this point, from a cost standpoint, and I know this goes towards your question, Steve Gracius, about will this solve every problem? Our only restrictions, as I said, are the exterior walls, because I don't know if you have the desire to want to encroach onto the play area outside.
Right.
That's a sizable cost difference.
Right.
So just so I know what to tell the architect, a concept would be just moving these interior walls in the new area and possibly going to the first floor, but leaving exterior walls alone.
In other words, no new foundation.
Yes.
Is that correct?
I think that's
probably
what we're
fair.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
That would be our recommendation.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. All right, well, we'll work on that.
I guess my only point is it depends on how many problems it would solve, right? And how many problems we want it to solve if we only stay within it, too. Just something to think of, you know, mm-hmm. something to think about.
I will tell you, though, without even having anything on paper, significantly different costs if you start going to a new foundation.
Because you're digging,
a new foundation.
You got your new foundation.
But if he's given us numbers, I don't know. Just something to think about.
The 1997 addition was put in place to make this concept more easily attainable, especially in the 10 weeks of summer. You start to build out, you may not open that wing by the start of the following school year. Not that, I'm not trying to dissuade you, but I'm just saying that.
You're dissuading me.
It's a different, it's a completely
yeah.
different project.
So if school out in the park.
Yeah, you're afraid to say the word mobile classroom, weren't you?
Yeah, it's not okay. Park.
But I'm also hearing that the administration is not that interested in doing that work, so I don't know that the board should. If that's not even a push from the administrators, look at that. I'd rather control our costs and try to solve the problems. And if it comes back that we can't solve problems at all, then maybe we go down, you know, jump off that next bridge. This is a big chunk. We do go negative in expenditures.
Soon.
Next year. The year after.
Next year.
So.
Unless.
Yeah. Okay. So we have consensus.
I'll set our piece.
Do you have what you need? Anyone else have anyone to throw in? Calvin? Yeah? No?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. You looked like you had maybe a little itch there.
I was looking at the picture.
Sure.
I'm okay.
Back of the napkin as at this point.
Thank you, Anthony.
All right, personnel.
There's a personnel report.
Are there any questions from any board members on the personnel report submitted?
Thank you.
Can I get a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Ms. Williams?
Yes.
Dr. Thompson?
Yes.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Mr. Martiri?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Oh, she has
no.
Oh, I'm sorry. She will abstain. Mrs. DeGracius?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Okay. Motion passes. So that brings us to a motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.